From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Here's a hopeful sound for dogs fans. That is UGA's victory bell that rings in Athens when the dogs win. Just ahead, we'll talk about college football's biggest game day in 35 years. First, though, last week, we heard the case for renaming Talmadge Memorial Bridge in Savannah.
When it comes to Eugene Talmadge, history is clear. The former Georgia governor ran his campaigns on a platform of segregation and white supremacy, and recently uncovered files reveal that he openly advocated the lynching of black citizens.
That's Jessica Lee Libos. Here are your first thoughts. Scott Cleveland from Savannah called to tell us he agrees with Jessica.
But the slippery slope that the state legislature is going to want to avoid is once that's changed, then the Lester Maddox Bridge that crosses the Chattahoochee River on I-75 needs to be changed, and my high school named after Joseph Wheeler will need to be changed. And I think what the state legislature is worried about is opening this can of worms and where it will go.
Joseph Wheeler was a Confederate officer and Alabama congressman. Lester Maddox was Georgia's governor during the late 1960s. He supported segregation and famously refused to serve any black customers at his restaurant in Atlanta. Last week, we also talked about how 70 Georgians were arrested because police found less than an ounce of marijuana at a party in Cartersville. Neil Cassidy tweets, "The police should have seen to it being flushed down the toilet, delivered a stern warning, and gone to look for real criminals." We always love to get your opinions. You can call us at 404-500-9457 like Scott did. We're also on Twitter. Find us there like Neil Cassidy did at OST Talk. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. So, Atlanta is right now the college football center of the world. The University of Georgia Dogs will try to stem the University of Alabama's tide. A win tonight for Georgia would be the first national championship victory for that team in more than 35 years. We have a preview for you with GPB's senior sports correspondent, John Nelson. He joins us on the line. Good morning.
Morning, Celeste.
And also with us from Bulldogs Country is University of Georgia sports journalism professor Vicki Michaelis. Welcome back.
Good morning to you.
So, Vicki, describe the scene. I mean, how crazy excited is the city right now?
You know, yesterday I was driving, I don't know where, somewhere early on a Sunday morning, right? And they had the people out selling jerseys, and people were there buying them. Normally on a Sunday morning in Athens, Georgia, I'm the only one out. So that's how crazy it is.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the chances of the UGA team. And John, let's go to you first. There's an extra sort of element of drama in this game, right? Because of the relationship between Kirby Smart and Nick Saban. Here's a recent press conference in which the Georgia coach, Kirby Smart, was asked what he had learned while working with Alabama coach Nick Saban.
You know, he never asked anybody in the organization to work any harder than he did. He held every person on the staff, and I'm not talking about just coaching staff, I'm talking about the entire organization, to be at their best. And I think that's sometimes a lost art in some organizations. You see successful business organizations run that way, but you don't always see athletic programs run that way.
John, how does that relationship play into this game?
Well, I mean, really, the first question that I would have is really, how much does the teacher teach the student? How much does he hold, you know, in his own little clipboard in the back, and how much does he reveal in these situations? I mean, if you want to get into statistics, Nick Saban is 11-0 when he's going up against former assistant coaches. So if you're a Georgia fan, you look at that number and you sit there and you go, okay, well, that doesn't bode well for us. But at the same time, Kirby Smart has developed into his own coach, and how much personality does Kirby have in this particular game? And in games in the past, in big games in the past, Nick Saban has had a tendency to overthink situations. How much overthinking does he do if it gets tight later on? You know, I look at this as almost like being at Talladega when you're at a NASCAR event, when you have all those cars in one line in the draft, looking at the aerodynamics of the situation. If the one car steps out of line, that car goes to the back of the line very quickly. Which one of these two coaches steps out of line, and can they get back in line to get focused on a win sooner than they can?
That's John Nelson comparing these two coaches to an automobile.
Yep.
Vicki, let's play one more comment here. This is Alabama head football coach Nick Saban, and he's saying that he feels good going into this game? They both say that, but here's Nick.
I've been really, really pleased with what this team has been able to accomplish this year. We've had to overcome a lot of adversity, and each and every time guys have stepped up and continue to compete at a high level, and something that we have a tremendous amount of appreciation for our staff and all the players on our team for what they've done and the opportunity they've created.
Is that Nick trying to claim underdog status?
I mean, they've had some players hurt. I'm trying to figure out what the adversity is there in Tuscaloosa.
Yeah, I mean, they're not the underdogs.
I don't think he can claim underdog status, you know, not when you're up against a team that hasn't won a national title for 37 years. That's tough.
Yeah, if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Vicki Michaelis, Georgia sports journalism professor and GPB sports correspondent John Nelson. So, Vicki, what has set this team apart? What has brought them to this game in ways that for 35 years running they haven't before?
I honestly think we're going to, and I think we already are seeing that the moment that set this team apart was Rodrigo Blankenship making that 55-yard field goal just before halftime against Oklahoma. Before then, the Bulldogs were always the team that might do it, could do it, probably won't do it. And at that moment, it was, well, the Bulldogs can do it. It made the impossible possible, and it made that second half possible. Makes anything possible tonight.
What about the players? Because a lot of people are talking about the fact that you actually have some more experienced players on the team that chose not to go to the NFL.
That core of seniors that came back, including Sony Michel, Nick Chubb, Lorenzo Carter, some, you know, big names, people who've made big plays this season. I think that's critical to what they've been able to do. That happens on other teams as well when teams see that they're close to doing something special. But it's also something that when you get them back, you have the leadership and you have confidence from the younger players saying, well, we've got the veterans to lead us.
John, how much do these college teams rely on superstars and as opposed to University of Alabama has a traditionally good football team? Which is more important?
I think that depth is more important, and I think that you've seen with the injuries that Alabama's had this season that they've been exposed. If you take into account what happened at the Iron Bowl, all the injuries that they had at linebacker, the injuries that they had on offensive line, and the depth in these situations shows where the professor has mentioned it. You know, the University of Georgia is like 38 deep at running back this season, and you've got to have that in this day and age of high-powered offenses where you really want to do things on the hop and when you can continue to shuttle players in and out and do it when they're healthy. I think in a season like this where you have playoff situations, where you're playing in championship games and you're working your way toward game 13, game 14, I think that the depth really matters. You can have all the five stars you want, but if a five star is injured and he's sitting on the bench and he's really done things for you in the first 10 or 11 games and he's not there for you in the last game of the year, that should speak volumes more than anything else.
So how much does this mean, Vicki, to the University of Georgia? And I say that because there have been recent debates over football programs in universities, whether they give back the kind of money and the kind of prestige that universities want.
I think there's a mixed bag here of what it does mean. Certainly it means everything to the athletic program. It means everything to the fans, the alumni who think it's important that we have a winning football team. But I can tell you that professors see the $30 million indoor practice facility, the $60 million renovations to Sanford Stadium, and we all know how much we have to struggle to get our programs funded, and we wonder what it means in the big picture.
And then, John, let's go to the sort of historic nature of this rivalry, because look, every single time I hear a sports announcer, they're talking about a rivalry. I mean, people can create sports rivalries out of nothing. So, is this a legit historic rivalry?
Not yet. I mean, because you have the divisional structure in the Southeastern Conference, there's not the rival that's there as part of your crossovers. Your traditional rivals for Georgia, first and foremost, are Auburn, the longest running rivalry in the history of Southern football. And you have Florida. So really, Alabama and Georgia would only be up against each other in a championship game situation in the Southeastern Conference. And really, if you were to ask a Georgia fan, I would say that Alabama, if it was any kind of a traditional rival, might be number three on your list when it comes to teams in the SEC. I think more than anything, what this game does is it reinforces every college football fan's hatred for the Southeastern Conference, who's outside of the Southeastern United States, because you had two SEC teams playing again for a championship.
Vicky, what do you make of that? Do people hate the SEC?
I couldn't agree more, actually. It's, you know, the people don't like the haves. The have-nots who are not in the SEC right now are wondering what it's going to take to break this conference's hold on this game.
Okay, so then let's talk a little bit about who might win, right? We have about 3 minutes left. So I'm going to go to you first, John, and tell us, what do you think we might see other than historic levels of traffic in Atlanta at a game where both teams are within driving distance?
You mean other than historic levels of traffic where both teams are within driving distance?
Yes, other than that.
No, I think that really right now you've seen the number for Las Vegas, for those of you that believe in those kinds of things, right now 3.5 to 4, which basically Las Vegas means...
You're talking about the betting odds.
Vegas thinks right now that this is a one-point game. And I think that, to the professor's point, I think that one of the key players in this game is going to be Rodrigo Blankenship. As a matter of fact, I think I have him as the MVP. And after this game is over, he will not have to pay for a single meal ever in the history of ever once this game is over. And considering Nick Saban's hatred for kickers and his easy quick hook in not using them in these games, I think that special teams could come in to play. And I think that really... don't anticipate the game being all that exciting. I think that if you wanted to pin down a flavor at an ice cream parlor for this game, I think it would be super vanilla.
Vicky, what do you think?
I mean, it's one of those things where you look on paper and you'd have to give it to Alabama, given Alabama's history in this game and how they look on paper and that depth that he referred to. But I do think that now that Georgia has seen the impossible happen in the Rose Bowl, and is they're still riding that high, it'll be interesting to see if that same magic plays tonight.
Well, it's not like the cold weather is going to be working against either one of them. Both of these are Southern teams, so they're both going to be cold, right?
Just the fans and the tailgaters. Those are the ones who'll be affected.
That is John Nelson. He is GPB's sports correspondent, and we also spoke with the University of Georgia sports journalism professor Vicky Michaelis. Thanks so much to both of you.
Be well.
Thank you for having me.
Tonight's national championship game between Georgia and Alabama starts at 8 o'clock at the Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta. Just a note, not only is that national championship game going to bring in a lot of fans from all around the Southeast, but the president is going to be coming with his wife as well, which will add to traffic. So be careful. Just ahead, we're going to talk about how to diversify classical music and art museums. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. Art museums have long struggled to attract non-white visitors, but the High Museum in Atlanta may have solved that problem. In the last couple of years, the museum's non-white audience has tripled. Rand Suffolk is the museum's director. Good morning and congratulations. These are enviable numbers.
We're excited about our progress. Thank you. Good morning.
And also with us is Mariette Westerman. She's the executive vice president of the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. The foundation follows demographics at art museums. Hi, Mariette.
Hi there. Great to be with you.
Mariette, let's start with you just so I can ask why it's important to the foundation to track the diversity of museums' visitors.
Well, if you believe that, as we do, art is a great resource for human flourishing and for a democratic society, it's very important that access to art in our great museums is available to all and to the maximum number of people. And so if you find out through tracking visitors that disproportionate numbers of people from particular communities, ethnic communities, racial communities, religious communities are not being served by museums, that's a real concern for the museum's viability and for their fulfilling their mission.
Over the weekend, we met with Shirley Zhu. She's of Alpharetta. She was at the High Museum. She's originally from China. And she was talking about an exhibit that featured Chinese art a while back, and it really resonated with her.
It makes me like feel proud. Also, kind of feel good to let people here to know, to understand the Chinese culture. So I hope there was more and more diversity here. I mean, then maybe next time when they see people in face, maybe make them feel easier to talk to each other, to integrate it and to communicate with each other.
So, Rand, you guys, as I understand it, now have 45% non-white visitors. Is that
That's
accurate?
Right. Until about 2015, traditionally, we averaged about 15% minority participation at the museum.
Which is comparable to other museums in cities.
I think the national average, the most recent data I saw, was about 9% across the United States. So you could say that that's pretty good. But if you live in a city like in Atlanta, that's bordering on unconscionable. At least that's our perspective. And so we've been working our tails off over the last 2 years to really change ourselves, not necessarily change our audience, but change ourselves as an organization to become a more compelling opportunity for people to engage with. And last year, we actually, as you said, we tripled that. It's now 45%. And this year, to date, halfway through the year, is actually at 48%.
Wow, which is kind of echoing the demographics of the city around you, which I assume is the aim?
That's exactly correct. We want to reflect the audience that we serve to the extent we can.
So let's hear from another visitor at the High. Raymond Edwards was also there this weekend, and he says he really enjoyed the exhibit on sneakers because they're such a big part of the African-American community here.
That they were able to broaden their horizon and to kind of tap into that sneaker culture, which, you know, blacks are really a big fan of. I thought it was fascinating. And bringing us here into the High Museum, it allows us to, you know, just get a different perspective and to kind of see ourselves in such a prestigious, you know, institutions like the High Museum.
Mariette, museums have long done exhibits of African-American artists. Is it often the art itself done by an African-American artist, or is it the art that shows people of color in it, or of whatever color they may be? What's sort of the key?
I would say it is both, Celeste. One important factor is that when people go to museums, it's a little bit like reading or going to the movies. On the one hand, a museum or a movie can open up a window onto the world for you. And those are often other worlds and other people, and you're probably going to be somewhat interested in them. But if you don't also see yourself mirrored in the institution or the book or the movie or the art, you may not have even an interest in opening that window.
So, Rand, the leadership of the High is still mostly white. The board of the High is still mostly white. And oftentimes when you talk about diversifying an institution, they say, look to the leadership first. How much of a challenge is that for you?
Well, I think we're a work in progress there. What I can tell you is that I think we've been trying very hard to look at this as a long-term process for ourselves. And so we've first, as I said, focused on how do we diversify the people coming to the museum? How do we begin to make sense for those individuals? And once we've started to get that, we're pretty excited there. We can sort of change our emphasis and say, okay, well, the people coming through our doors reflects the audience that we serve, but does our membership look like that? Okay, well, now we need to spend the next 18 months really focusing, 2 years focusing on changing the, you know, what our membership looks like. And at the same time, you start to look then at your board and you say, okay, does the board, our membership reflects the audience that we serve, the people coming through the door, does our board look like that? Does our staff look like that? And, you know, one of the great phrases I've heard before is sort of relentless incrementalism. I mean, this is an ongoing project. And so to the extent that we're going to make a difference, it's about making a series of gestures, a series of decisions along the way and staying committed to that and being very intentional about how we try and shift the demographics top to bottom at the organization. I can tell you that from a staff standpoint as well as from a board standpoint, we're very sensitive to that. We're very excited that our efforts are starting to gain traction, and I think we'll continue to make progress moving forward.
Let's hear from yet another visitor to the High. In 2015, the High featured an exhibit of photographs from the photographer Gordon Parks, an African-American who documented life during the Jim Crow years of the South. And this is Chris Dorelis, who lives in Atlanta.
That's the last time I was here, so I came out to see that. Just seeing people that look like us doing other things definitely is inspirational. You know, growing up, I feel like African Americans are placed in the box. We see a lot of, you know, athletes and entertainers. So just seeing that, you know, we could do art and other things, it's inspiring and shows that we could reach for more.
So, Mariette, how does this argument go when perhaps the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation is speaking to museums and urging them to make these kinds of changes? Is it usually an economic argument in terms of getting more ticket sales?
Well, you have to believe in the mission of museums and of bringing art to as many people as possible as a good thing to start. So if you don't have that commitment, you probably won't get to the economic argument. But yes, there is an economic argument for the long term to be made. As Rand has said, this is a long-term proposition and you have to stay on it. If you look at the demographics of American society, the census projections are that by 2050, there will not be a single ethnic or racial or any other kind of majority, except perhaps women, in the United States. And so if you want to have those the full community of the American society come to your museums, and that's essential to your economic viability long term, whether it's ticket sales or people spending money in your cafes or restaurants, or in fact becoming philanthropically supportive of your enterprise.
Rand, you guys also got rid of audio guides, which is a staple of museums. Why?
Well, we look at diversity and inclusivity from a number of different perspectives, not only based on ethnicity. And so one of the things that we're, is again, a series of gestures. How do we default towards just trying to do the right thing to engage our audience? One of the things we decided to do was that we noticed that our numbers of people actually using those audio guides was diminishing over time. It just didn't seem to make sense for us. So we said, well, what if we took those dollars and put them towards some other things that would be more generative? And so one of the decisions we made was that we would dedicate ourselves to having an ASL interpreter at every single public program that we do. Again, it's not that we can be all things to all people, but how do we send a signal continuously that we're thinking about our audience and trying to not just create one gateway, but multiple gateways for them to connect with their museum?
So, Mariette, I actually had a conversation with an art director who I will allow to remain anonymous, who mm-hmm. said there's always this pull, right? Because you have a responsibility to educate the public about past masters and make sure that they are seeing art by Van Gogh and many of the other great masters through history. And then you also have this pull to introduce them to new audiences, and sometimes you don't really get as much time as you would want to consider diversity. Is there kind of a working calculation on how museums should make those determinations?
I think the statement you just paraphrased is a characteristic of an attitude that has long prevailed among museum leaderships and probably boards. Rand and several other museum directors around the country consider themselves chief diversity officers, by which they don't mean that they're the only ones waking up every day thinking about diversity and inclusion, but they do take it into account into all their decision-making, program decisions, and so forth. So I think as long as museum directors think that diversity is this other thing they have to think about rather than something that's fundamental to being a museum in America today, it's going to be very hard to make progress.
And I would just, I think that's it's important to understand that, you know, I don't think that the goals and the objectives of the colleague that you just quoted are mutually exclusive from creating an inclusive audience. I mean, I think there's always some balance that you're trying to navigate. I mean, that's one of the great exciting and compelling things about being a general fine arts museum is that as long as we're focused on our mission and quality, we can do pretty much whatever the heck we want to in terms of, you know, engaging people with different perspectives, different artists' work and so forth. And that's truly the exciting work. And it's not just about using those materials, I think, to communicate to an audience, but using those materials to communicate with your audience writ large. I mean, because sharing those multiple perspectives, we want to be a place where all of Atlanta is comfortable coming together. And we want to be a place where all of those people can come and learn from each other and, you know, have a shared experience about the thoughts or the perspectives, the artists and their voices that are presented in our exhibitions.
So I imagine you're taking calls from other museums who are trying to figure out how you did it and how they can duplicate it?
We've gotten great response from colleagues around the country to a recent article that was put out about our efforts and so forth. But look, I think across the board, there are art museums around the country that are all very sensitive to this and are very focused on how do we do the right thing when it comes to diversify our audience. And it's going to be different wherever you are. You know, what counts and what we consider to be diversity here is going to be very different than what you might think of in Tulsa, Oklahoma, or in Portland, Maine, and so forth. And so I think we're all working very hard to try and become a different kind of resource within our communities.
That is Rand Suffolk. He's the director of Atlanta's High Museum of Art. And we also heard from Mariette Westerman, the executive vice president of the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Pleasure to be here.
Let's segue from art to music. If you love a cappella singing, you might be a fan of the Pitch Perfect series.
Come on, come on, turn the radio on. It's Friday night and it won't be long. Gotta do my hair, put my makeup on. It's Friday night and it won't be long.
That's actress Anna Kendrick playing the lead role in the most recent of those films. That movie, like many other blockbusters, was filmed right here in Georgia. If you see it and stay through to the credits, you may spot Ryan Christopher Taylor's name. He lives in Marietta and worked as a key assistant location manager on the film. Ryan's also working as location manager on the Fox TV show Star. Some of his other credits include Georgia-based projects like Anchorman 2, Furious 7, and The Walking Dead. On Second Thought, regular Kalina Baller caught up with Ryan to learn more about what a location manager does behind the scenes.
As a location manager, my job is to obviously make sure that our machine is moving forward, make sure that the keys are set up for success and that they have everything rolling for the support for the locations that we have found. Keeping neighbors happy, keeping property owners happy, diffusing situations that come up when people are not happy. And sometimes it's not fair, sometimes it is valid complaints. It's a matter of working with and for the producers and the production designer and the director to achieve what the director wants, but also there's damage control that goes with that. I was proud of the work I did on Anchorman 2 in St. Simons, given some of the circumstances we had faced on that show. Again, it was, you know, I was working 6-7 days a week and I was stationed in St. Simons for 6 weeks and dealing with entities and people I'd never even, I was just diving into the deep end, better yet being thrown into the deep end, like the Department of Natural Resources and Glenn County municipalities and the head lawyer there. But in Pitch Perfect 3, you know, that was huge. Now, actually on that show, it was a USO tour within the storyline, and, you know, we had large extra count days with like 1,000, you know, 500 extras and then 500 Army personnel and things like that. I didn't have a whole lot to do with that, but, like, I did create France, Nice, France, in Glenwood Park. Like, blue and, like you know, blue and yellow paint on window frames. And we're talking about doing a very large-scale production in a very compact, tight-knit, very film-friendly community. And they were all really great. But I think I walk away from every show with a sense of satisfaction and also I can appreciate the value in like finding that last minute location the day before it shoots or pulling it all together, you know, right at the deadline.
That's Ryan Christopher Taylor, who works on locations for movies and TV shows in Georgia. One of his latest titles is Pitch Perfect 3. It's now in theaters. That interview was originally recorded for The Credits Podcast, produced by Zero Mile Media. It's online at thecreditspodcast.com. Just ahead, how exactly do you get kids of color to love classical music? This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Classical music has a diversity problem, and it has for a long time. The League of American Orchestras says people of color make up only about 4% of U.S. symphonies players. In Georgia, the Atlanta Music Project, or AMP, wants to balance those scales. The program provides free training and instruments to underserved students in Southwest Atlanta. Last year, AMP won a grant of $80,000 from the Carnegie Hall Foundation. That's one of only 13 awarded across the country. My colleague Adam Ragusa talked about this with Dante Rameau, co-founder and executive director of the Atlanta Music Project. He also spoke with Rick Robinson, founder of Cut Time Productions in Detroit. It works to make classical music accessible to a wider audience.
I note that, before we start talking about your respective programs and the work that you're doing, you're both men of color who play classical music for a living, and I wonder if you couldn't both just tell us a little bit about how you came to be who you are, how you came to find that career. Dante, could you start with us? Let's start with you, Dante. Got it right. Okay.
Sure. I grew up in Canada, and my parents are, my dad is from Haiti, and my mom is from Cameroon. And they just wanted me exposed to as many different extracurriculars as possible. And for whatever reason, the one that they didn't give me a choice about was piano lessons. I was allowed to play basketball and do other kinds of activities, but they forced me to do piano. And I had a knack for it, and they supported my progress. And I ended up going to a magnet high school for the arts, where I majored in bassoon and saxophone. And it just came easily, and the hard work part of it I always enjoyed. So I ended up going to do a Bachelor of Music and a Master of Music.
And Rick, how did you fall into this?
Well, I grew up in a musical family. My older brother and sister played violin and cello, and then David took up bass and saxophone. Our mother played piano and sang at the piano, and she loved going through the classical repertory at the piano. It just moved her so much. And then my father taught himself guitar, and he'd do folk singing, and he'd lead audiences. So my whole family has been musical and leaders in the community.
So, Dante, what does the Atlanta Music Project do?
Well, the Atlanta Music Project is now in its eighth year of operations, and what we do is we provide intensive music education for underserved youth right in their neighborhood. And a lot of people ask me, well, Dante, what do you mean by underserved? And what we'll do is we'll look at neighborhoods and communities in metropolitan Atlanta and identify areas where you might not find a lot of youth orchestras or youth choirs, or you might not find very robust music programs in the schools. So we're targeting musically underserved neighborhoods. But this usually is found in neighborhoods where you have a lot of schools with high rates of free reduced lunch students, and also neighborhoods where there are lower levels of income. So we tend to end up in neighborhoods south of I-20 in Atlanta.
Let's listen to some of your kids. Here is the AMP Orchestra performing Fanfare for the Common Man by Aaron Copland last year. So Dante Rameau, a lot of the kids you can see in this video are very, very young, and I imagine you're starting them late in a lot of circumstances. They sound pretty good nonetheless. What is your goal? What do you consider success with these kids?
Well, becoming a musician, proficient on a music instrument, requires a lot of skills and character traits that I think are valuable and applicable to all parts of your life. So sure. Mostly I want our kids to feel a very high sense of self-worth. I want them to feel like they matter, like their voice matters, and that they can do really big things. And we just happen to be using music as a vehicle. You can do it through sports. You can do it through academics. We just happen to be doing it through music. So an example is we've got three students who this summer got to participate in a national music festival called Take a Stand in Los Angeles, and they got to perform at Walt Disney Concert Hall, home of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, under the baton of Gustavo Dudamel, the famous conductor. And, you know, this is all due to their hard work and their dedication to their craft. And I think when they have those kinds of experiences, I think they feel like they have more control over the outcome in their lives.
Rick Robinson with Cut Time Productions in Detroit. You're doing different things to try to make classical music more accessible to people who might not necessarily normally find it or be exposed to it. You've got this group called the Cut Time Players. It's an octet. And let's go ahead and just play some of that music so that people can hear how lively your concerts are. They're going to start playing the music underneath you. Just go ahead and tell us about the Cut Time Players.
Okay, well, I started it back in 1994 while I was a member of Detroit Symphony Orchestra. And I realized that there are a lot of people who never come to Orchestra Hall to hear us, so we should be taking the music to them. And eventually, once the smoking laws came along, grew this movement called Classical Revolution that began in San Francisco. And I joined that in organizing music volunteers in restaurants and clubs and bars to start sharing classical music as entertainment in those places so we could reach a new audience.
And yeah, the concerts, if you people go and listen to the music online, they just sound like a whole lot of fun. Do you think that the mission is working?
I think it's growing. It necessarily starts small because we need to experiment for what people react most positively to. And, you know, it tends to be the cream of the crop, something familiar, something with a strong beat and ways that they can join in, like playing toy percussion with us.
That's great. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dante Rameau, executive director of the Atlanta Music Project, and also Rick Robinson, founder of Cut Time Productions in Detroit, two gentlemen who are trying to make classical music more accessible to a wider array of people. And Dante, I wonder, the argument that you make about the value of classical music education is very, very strong, and it's a very, very common argument. But it's, you know, it fundamentally is the case that historically speaking, classical music is a European tradition, and if kids, especially kids of color, don't find it to be really relevant to them, do you ever worry that maybe you're foisting European cultural hegemony on them?
No, I don't worry about that, because what we're doing is we're teaching kids the language of music. And we happen to start at the very beginning in a, I guess you can call it a traditional Western music education philosophy, where you're learning to read notes and, you know, you're playing semitones and tones and half steps and whole steps and all that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, we're teaching them to play an instrument, and they now have the ability, once they get to a level of proficiency where they can read any kind of music, where they can play by ear, they can now do whatever they want. And I think that's really, really empowering. And, of course, at the Atlanta Music Project, 95% of our students are African-American. So we have to be very, very intentional about what kind of repertoire we have our kids playing. So, of course, we'll teach them Mozart, Beethoven, but we also do pop music, and we also do jazz, and we also do spirituals. In fact, last year we did an entire concert of only black music, music from the Caribbean, music from Africa, music from black America. So we don't, it's really about giving them the power to do what they want, but also being mindful of where we are teaching, being mindful of the culture of our students, and being mindful of the diversity that's available in music.
Sure. Let's actually listen to some other kinds of music that your kids do. You've got a choral group, called Amplify. Amplify Zabin is the name of this choir, performing a choral arrangement of the Andra Day song Rise Up. That's nice, Dante. Do you do that arrangement yourself?
No, I did not. I will give all credit to our director of choirs, Aisha Moody, and our choir director, Verena Lucia Anders. I'll stay out of that one, but thank you.
Okay. Rick Robinson, founder of Cut Time Productions in Detroit, sort of a similar question to you. You know, if people aren't finding classical music on their own, is that potentially an indication that it is legitimately not relevant to their cultural identity and their life experience? And, you know, what's the value of pushing it on them?
Well, I find, you know, life is always about how we look at things, how we take things. And while classical music has this past of being European, I mean, just like books, it becomes a universal source of not only inspiration, but self-reflection, as well as getting your voice out. So the ability to read English can lead to being able to write books or articles or rants if we want to. And the same can be said for music. If we pick up this tool off the floor, blow the dust off, it becomes a very powerful tool.
Dante, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I would just say that it's really important that when it comes to children, and we don't make any assumptions about them. You know, just because there's an 8-year-old that's growing up in Southwest Atlanta doesn't mean that that child may not be interested in a variety of music genres. Most of our kids, I admit, you know, they love hip hop. But then again, I love hip hop. But I have 2 degrees in classical music, and I do it professionally. So I think it's important to expose kids to many different things. And it's okay for them to like more than one genre of music. I mean, it's all good, right? So we just have to be very careful about putting assumptions on students. I think we'd be surprised if we just gave them the chance to try something and then see where, if they like it. If they don't, fine. If they do, great.
Certainly. Have you found ways of integrating hip-hop with the classical music that you teach them?
As close we got was last year we did a Bruno Mars piece called Treasure. So not quite hip hop, but I think what would be really cool would be to involve a DJ or obviously an MC, and who knows, that may be in the future.
Are we speaking with Dante Remote? Oh, go ahead.
I've become a composer in the last 12 years or so, and I've found ways of blending hip-hop and urban pop styles with classical just as a composer. And then furthermore, more recently, I've been working with some spoken word artists, some poets, and doing some classical, you know, loops underneath them. So there's plenty of potential for the two cultures to meet.
When you do it, Rick, do you do it in sort of a winking, oh, isn't this juxtaposition amusing, or do you try to keep it sincere?
Well, there's always a certain authenticity that comes with spoken word artists that sure. is missing from instrumental music that has no lyrics or much context. So one hand washes the other, if you will.
That's Rick Robinson, founder of Cut Time Productions, a classical music ensemble in Detroit working to spread classical music to people who might not otherwise hear it. Also with us is Dante Rameau, executive director of the Atlanta Music Project, working to bring classical music to youth of color, primarily in Atlanta. Let me ask both of you, what do you think that the big classical music institutions, the big symphony orchestras, the operas, what could they learn from your experiences in terms of trying to reach a broader audience, Dante?
Go to the people instead of always inviting the people to come to, you know, a mega structure in the middle of the city.
So you mean physically go to them?
Absolutely. I think you have to, if you want to reach people, you have to give them the honor of meeting them where they are, and then sharing the music in a way that is that makes sense for that community. So, for example, with the Atlanta Music Project, we make sure that we are in recreation centers. We have great partnerships with the city of Atlanta and some Atlanta public schools as well. And we make sure that we're in the neighborhood after school where the kids need a place to go that's safe. We also make sure that we partner with other groups that provide homework and that provide a warm dinner. after our classes. Mm-hmm. So it's really important to look at the community that you're trying to reach and kind of do the work, the research, and fit yourself into that community. Obviously, the music doesn't change, but it's the way you approach it that I think needs to be thought out a little bit more.
Rick, same question to you in the last minute that we have. What can the big institutions in classical music learn from what you're doing in terms of trying to reach a broader audience?
Well, I found that going out into the communities means standing in the middle sometimes to try to be that central pillar on the bridge. And for a bridge to be successful, the traffic has to flow in both directions at some points. So before people will actually listen for the value of classical music, often we have to listen to what the community wants to offer us, and they do want to offer us their music. So it's on this bridge, everyone can play well with each other, but it does take some give more than take.
That image of standing in the middle of the bridge playing, it makes me think of another thing that I imagine you probably deal with, which is that classical musicians are used to, in traditional contexts, having everyone be totally silent while they play.
Right.
Have you had to try to get over that expectation, Rick?
And I've successfully done that with amplification. And then keeping people's attention with hosting, a good host who can engage or just act like a DJ who's a member of the family, and just approaches even strangers with agape, you know, a love of humanity, yeah, can bring us together.
That's Rick Robinson, founder of Cut Time Productions, talking with my colleague Adam Ragusea in September. You also heard Dante Rameau, co-founder and executive director of the Atlanta Music Project. Their first concert of 2018 will be a Black History Month show on February 10th. You can get more information at atlantamusicproject.org. And that's our show for today, but we would love to hear from you. Who are you rooting for in tonight's college football game, and why is it UGA? No, just kidding. Are there any predictions that you have for tonight, especially if you think there'll be some surprises? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also reach us on Twitter. The show is at OST Talk, and I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.